On Saturday, November the 18th, from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the African Restaurant on 247 West 116th Street, New York City, that's in Harlem, there's going to be a very significant meeting. It's a planning meeting for the fourth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. People are going to be coming to that meeting in Harlem, not just from throughout the Northeast, but all across the country. And in addition to that, there are going to be foreign delegations there as well. We don't know exactly how many people. Sarah might be able to tell you that, but I want to stress once again that the importance of a political event isn't always gauged by its numbers. Its significance, I think, is often best determined by its content and what kind of action comes out of it. If you want more information about this, get your pen or pencil and take this down in just a couple of moments. On Thursday, November the 23rd, a day that is sometimes referred to as Thanksgiving, there's going to be an event sponsored by the Rosa Parks Human Rights Day Committee, along with the United American Indians of New England, and that will be at 12 noon on Coles Hill, which is the hill right above Plymouth Rock. And typically what happens is those who assemble there bury Plymouth Rock. And they've become, I think, very adept at this through the years, getting earth movers and whatnot before the police show up. If you've ever seen some of this stuff on television, it is a sight to see. So we urge everybody to attend that as well. And then finally, we're going to begin local organizing after we come back from the meeting in New York City for March the 17th, 2007. So we're thinking that with the fourth anniversary rolling around, with probably changes in Washington, this may represent another opportunity to have our voices heard and keep the pressure on. You can phone us at 413-587-0059. That's 413-587-0059. To email us, please email, and this is all in lowercase, WMASSIAC at hotmail.com. Okay? And it seems so self-evident. What have you been seeing in the newspapers about Lebanon recently? Not much. It's been pushed to the back pages. And there's a publication called Electronic Lebanon. Some of you who visit the website Electronic Intifada will find a link to this. And there's some tremendously interesting material. And I just want to read you a small portion of this because this was published the other day. And it says, the title of this is War Still Keenly Felt in Lebanon. And it begins, current events are like hot air balloons, says Arundhati Roy. They rise up into view and disappear out of sight again. This seems to be the situation now in Lebanon. Many thousands and colleagues abroad are emailing to ask what's going on since Lebanon is no longer in the news. Our hot air balloons have already disappeared. Well, tonight we're going to try to bring this back into view and into sharp relief. And Sarah Flounders, a co-director of the International Action Center, will be speaking with us. Ms. Flounders is someone who is a member of the delegation from the Campaign for Accountability on U.S. and Israeli War Crimes in Lebanon and Palestine. She traveled to Lebanon immediately after the Israeli bombing ended. She's an editor and co-author of 5 books dealing with the U.S. role in the Middle East, and she participated in 2 delegations to Palestine during the Second Intifada. And by the way, Sarah also traveled with Ramsey Clark and others several times to Iraq during the years that the U.S. sanctions were in force. It's with great pleasure that I present to you our good friend, Sarah Flounders.
Thanks so much, and I'm glad to see everyone here tonight. I brought a DVD of a video that's in progress based on the delegation to Lebanon, and I think we'll begin the program with showing this video. A lot of what I'll be saying, sometimes a picture is worth 1,000 words, and it might be better to start off with that. sometimes a picture to see the level of destruction of what happened in Beirut. And not only in Beirut, the man from the civil defense who was naming one town and city after another in the south of Lebanon that was just bombed to rubble. More than 1 million refugees, people literally driven from their homes, and their homes, and not only the homes, but the entire infrastructure, electricity, roads, fuel, winter coming now. When you see this level of destruction and know that this was all carried out with U.S. weapons and U.S. political and diplomatic support, that is the whole purpose of the delegation that traveled to Lebanon was to substantiate the charges of U.S.-Israeli war crimes in Lebanon and in Palestine. And I'm sure anyone who's following the news knows just yesterday where Israeli troops fired into a demonstration of women, killing two women and injuring, I think, at least 10. And that's just one day of Israeli occupation that continues every day in Gaza, if you're following the news, or the targeted assassinations going on in the West Bank. This is all carried out with U.S. weapons and support. It's $15 million a day, every day, for the last 50 years supplied to the State of Israel, because this represents corporate power in the Middle East today. I actually, before, though, talking more about Lebanon, I really want to start with Iraq, because the U.S. occupation in Iraq, if you follow it on the news today, and there is a real change taking place in the consciousness in this country. You see any poll, and the majority of the population is against the war and has been for the last couple of years. But there's a certain point in which that passive opposition begins to undergo its own real change. And the anger about the war in Iraq is becoming a political phenomena, which may express itself even in the election next week. It certainly looks that way. Even though there's no Democratic politician who really represents an anti-war position. But when people are voting, they're thinking this anybody but Bush. They want to have some way of responding on the war. And that in itself becomes a political phenomena. The U.S. occupation in Iraq is really unraveling much, much faster than could have even been imagined. And the U.S. military today, you listen to any of the top generals who are there, and they have no hope of stabilizing the situation. They pinned all their hopes that by moving a tremendous number of their troops to Baghdad, they could subdue Baghdad through, they closed the entire city, set up checkpoints everywhere. And as they said at the time, as goes the capital, so the country. Well, too true, because what's happening to them right now in Beirut, where they were even forced by the very puppet government they created, this completely corrupt puppet government, ordered the takedown of checkpoints throughout Beirut because they couldn't sustain their own position. All of these developments, there's not only no hope of stabilizing the situation in Iraq, but there's also no hope or expectation of any reconstruction taking place. $21 billion has been spent, and there's less electricity, less than 4 hours a day in the capital, in Baghdad today, less potable water than there was right after the invasion, and less than a third what it was before the invasion. after years and years, 13 years of sanctions. So this budget has now run out, and there's no new funds coming. And that's important to recognize, that they've just stopped. They shoveled billions of dollars into Halliburton and other major U.S. corporations. It did nothing for the people of Iraq. It's important when you see, actually I want to compare this, and I'll be talking about it a little bit more, to the situation in Lebanon, where you have a mass resistance organization that was able to begin reconstruction the day the bombing ended and to promise to the entire population $10,000 to every family for their housing needs this year. And if their homes aren't rebuilt in a year, they can again apply for that next year. And that was done not just for the Shia population, but for the entire population. Really, the war in Lebanon was at U.S. instigation. There was more than a year of U.S. planning and preparation for this war. It was a war that it was hoped would change the political climate and the mood and be the first step to wider war, opening up a war against Syria and Iran, and that by pushing back and wiping out Hezbollah, U.S. power would gain a whole new wave within the region. That was the plan this summer. And instead, what happened? Israel had their first real defeat in 50 years. They were absolutely driven out of Lebanon, and they were unable to secure not only one city, but one town, one village. And while the U.S. refused in any way to help broker a peace agreement for a month of the bombing, when it was clear that Israel literally couldn't sustain their position another week, they suddenly moved very quickly for a ceasefire. So their plans for the conquest of the region suffered another enormous setback and collapse. Now, the situation, though, today, in a way, could become even more dangerous because, as I say, Democratic Party, any U.S. politician has no plan for how to withdraw from the region and no expectation and hope of doing so because their wealth, corporate power in the U.S., is today completely bound up in their control of the entire region. So it's not the end of the wars that they will attempt. And as they grow more desperate, their plans may become wilder yet. Who would have expected at the beginning of last summer that the entire country of Lebanon would be bombed? It had nothing to do with the grabbing of two Israeli soldiers, which has happened before, and which was to set up a prisoner exchange for Lebanese soldiers who've been held for years and years. So U.S. plans suffered a big setback this summer when they were unable, through using Israel as their weapon, as their point in the entire region, suffered this big setback. It was a big miscalculation. You could say it was a howling blunder. And the fact that it was set back by a very grassroots resistance organization that had overwhelming support in the population. Now, the entire war was fought on the basis of destroying Hezbollah, disarming Hezbollah. That was the reason behind the war, if you follow any of the press here, that Hezbollah had to be disarmed, that it was a terrorist organization. That shaped the whole debate and discussion for months, if we think back to it. And it's so true, as Nick was saying in the beginning, sometimes these things go up like hot air balloons and it just disappears. Who's following this discussion in the press anymore? They want you to forget it because it was such a big setback for them. They want you to just not notice what happened. What happened every day, including even the rush shipment to Israel in the last week of a whole new generation of bunker busters, so they could go after one target after another, which they claimed were Hezbollah sites, and which really were the infrastructure, bridges, tunnels, as you saw the woman describing, oil refinery, the environmental havoc, because they're all the people who are dislocated. But when you destroy hundreds of miles of coastline, what happens to the lives of the fishermen? When Israel dropped more than a million cluster bombs after the ceasefire was agreed to. The ceasefire was agreed to, and they said it will go into effect in 3 days, 72 hours. And it was during that time that Israel dropped more than a million cluster bombs in the south of Lebanon, carpeting whole villages, agricultural land. It means that people returning, you don't know where these little silver pieces, not much larger than a little battery, very attractive to children. They're in cars, they're in apartments, they're in the limbs of trees, they're in the ground as a plow goes over, as you walk. It's a huge problem. I know it was very much on our minds as we were traveling in the south of Lebanon, because actually the day we were there was the day that the Israeli press, Haaretz newspaper, had quoted that day an Israeli general saying that what we did was inhuman and immoral beyond calculation, that we carpeted the ground with cluster bombs when there was no reason even to do so. It was pure vindictiveness, vengeance, and anger at their defeat. This was Israel's fifth invasion of Lebanon. And that's also important to keep in mind. This is not the first effort or the second, but it's been a continuing one time after another. More than 90% of the casualties were civilian, and more than a third of them children. And that really is always true in war, especially today and the way the U.S. fights wars. We could look at the figures in Iraq or know the figures in Yugoslavia or in the Gulf War I or in Afghanistan today. Who's targeted? Especially when the resistance army is part of the population itself, that the only effort is to use mass terror. And this was a tactic that was learned from the Nazis. That really is the only thing that you could compare it to, when you bomb an entire town. Now, South Beirut that you see in the opening part of this film looks like Brooklyn, if you were traveling there. Actually, the entire country of Lebanon has less than the population of Brooklyn. So when you destroy a whole section of apartment blocks and 10-story buildings and the TV and radio and such, that is an effort to terrorize the whole population and break their will. And instead, it was the opposite that happened. Now, I want to discuss also, since so much was said at the time of Hezbollah being the real reason why the war was fought, it's important to have some understanding of what Hezbollah is beyond the propaganda. And it was why, when we traveled there, we went out of our way to interview, to meet with members of Hezbollah to see their take. Why should we allow only our own government to define these issues for us? As Hezbollah is seen throughout the Arab world, it is seen as a social and political organization first. It is understood to be an organization that runs a whole series of hospitals and schools and social programs that has done more to build the infrastructure in Lebanon that holds about a quarter of the seats in the Lebanese parliament that has elected representatives in towns and in villages, on city councils, not just in the national parliament, and that had a resistance organization that had been extremely effective in actually ending the Israeli occupation that had gone on for 18 years in Lebanon, from 1982 to the year 2000. It was Hezbollah as an armed resistance organization that had been able to drive the Israelis out. So the success of Hezbollah in driving out Israel again and ensuring that they could secure no village, no town in the entire south was seen as an enormously proud accomplishment. And it was interesting that everywhere we went in Lebanon, not only among the Shia population and not only among the Muslim population, about a third of the population of Lebanon is Christian. And so to see the amount of support that they had from average people, quite a large number of Lebanese people have family in the U.S., speak English, are very well able to talk to just on the street. We weren't there part of an official delegation being shown around by anyone. We were just traveling around on our own. But what was raised again and again was a description of Hezbollah as being the ones who had supplied health care in the past and social organization. Now, Lebanon, just to describe a little bit, because, you know, whenever the U.S. wants to justify their war, they talk about how they are a stabilizing force within an area, that they're trying to bring together contending forces, and they'll give you some whole phony anthropological view about these contending factions and religious groupings. It's how they describe Iraq today, that they just can't stop the Shia and the Sunni and the Kurds from killing each other, and a problem that never existed before. And that's important to know. And it's the same way that French colonial occupation had been carried out in Lebanon historically, and the U.S. picked up from this. Originally, Lebanon was a very multi-ethnic, multi-religious country, and under French colonial rule, the entire state structure of Lebanon was rigidly divided into religious groupings. There was no civil society, no social services. Lebanon was organized along these different religious groupings, as different from many other countries even in the region. And even today, access to schools, to health services, to jobs, to small business loans, to marriage is strictly based on what religious sect you belong to. The same was true for voting, by the way, and for representation in the government, whether Sunni or Shia or Muslim or Maronite Catholic or Orthodox Christian or Druze or numerous subgroupings. Each grouping had their own political party and their own militia. It's not only Hezbollah that had militias. Everyone in Lebanon is armed. And in that sense, there was really no national government. That's sort of a fiction in many ways. The structure was so rigidly defined that the way it's set up, the president must be Christian, the prime minister must be Sunni, the speaker of the house must be Shia. You know, regardless of their program or the elections or how it goes, this is the way it has been. And it's set up so strictly that there has been no census in Lebanon for 80 years, because they can't upset this balance as it was in the 1920s. So under French colonialism and then under U.S. domination, by arming one militia against another, they were able to always keep the situation unstable. I think everyone in this society knows a way in which racism is used. the way in which attacks on immigrant workers are used, the way in which divisions in society can keep people absolutely preoccupied. And this is how corporate power rules in the U.S. And it's not so different, really, in Lebanon. Into this came a political organization who provided health care for the entire population. Hezbollah set up hospitals that were available to anyone and everyone, not just to the Shia population. Now, that was a rather revolutionary concept. Hezbollah did something else. They said, we are strictly a religious, resistance organization against the Israeli occupation. And we will not use our guns against any Lebanese group. And they kept to this, even when in big rallies, their demonstrations were shot into by one group or another, and they knew who did it. And maybe from their own ranks, people would say, we want justice, we want retribution. They'd say, no, we will not use our weapons against even our opponents within Lebanese society. Our guns are to be used against the Israeli occupation. And that statement and opening up the resistance also to other groupings also was a very revolutionary act within the concept, within the structure of how Lebanon had been set up. And it was a very powerful, therefore, kind of resistance. It really had support at the grassroots level. Now, the reconstruction of Lebanon is quite an accomplishment, because we don't want to only talk about what's happening in Iraq, where they were unable to reconstruct anything in almost 4 years. But we could look just at the experience in New Orleans and the Gulf States more than a year after Hurricane Katrina and Rita, where the entire city of New Orleans, except for the downtown commercial strip and the wealthiest areas that had stayed dry, the rest of the city has just been let go. And not just by accident or inability to rebuild. Well, there's more equipment in the U.S. for rebuilding than anywhere else on the face of the earth, but it's also a decision as to who gets assistance in the U.S. and who doesn't. Endless money, billions of dollars, for Halliburton. But the idea that the average person is very interesting. The maximum that was offered after Hurricane Katrina to families absolutely destitute was $2,000 a family. Remember this? I mean, these are things that we know. You can imagine the impact in Lebanon, where you say it's $10,000 to every family who suffered any loss. As a matter of fact, it was some of the Christians who in Lebanon this made the biggest impact on. They would say to us, well, maybe our losses weren't even as great as our neighbors, and yet no distinction was made here. That, to them, was absolutely incredible. The landfill you see in this film and the 1,000 trucks a day, a truck a minute, 24/7 coming into this landfill, a reconstruction effort because, you know, when buildings are bombed, they then literally have to be torn down. If the foundations are cracked, a lot of buildings that don't even seem that damaged, but you see fault lines going all the way down, they have to literally be taken apart. So that reconstruction effort was a huge effort, and it was also being organized by Hezbollah. The government, a month later, and it's now 3 months later, is still studying the situation, the National Lebanese Government. And that's something that we know so well from New Orleans, that they can study this situation for months, for years at a time, and folks are still living in FEMA trailers, those who are lucky enough to have it. So this kind of, I really want to leave a lot of time. There are all kinds of points that I could make in terms of this small trip and the effort that came out of it, because really all during the bombing there were demonstrations taking place around the country and around the world on a weekly, and it seemed almost every other day there were actions, there were demonstrations, there were protests against what the whole world could see. I mean, the coverage was nightly on the television. So the effort was to organize a political challenge to this, both by making this video, publishing a book, making an educational packet in the schools, because what happens when there's a war like this, it's in the news intensely for a few days, and then it completely disappears. And history, social science, all kinds of people who are teaching classes look for material 2 weeks later, and they only can rely on the same government that lied to them about the reasons for the war supplying the information, the recap on it. So we thought, well, we want to try to have a real people's effort on this. So the visit there, and it was under very difficult conditions. I mean, here we were, just a handful of people in a car on roads that were still destroyed, on bridges that were still destroyed, traveling through an area where people were trying to come back but were still really encamped, where not all, one of the things in the South was what was targeted in every one of the towns were the gas stations and the supermarkets, because the idea was to try to depopulate the South in order to occupy it, depopulate it through the mines and through the cluster bombs, but also depopulate it in ways so that the average person would have a great deal of difficulty coming back and either farming their land or even how do they supply food, how do they shop, how do they get gas for their car, you know, all of those things. That was consciously pinpoint accuracy everywhere destroyed. So we were traveling through some areas where it was extremely difficult and where maybe before the war it would take 2 hours, it might take many, many, many more hours to travel. So many of the people we spoke to had stayed, a lot of people had left, and then immediately after the war, come back, because this is a population who has seen what happened, and they've experienced it. The Palestinian population still lives among them. They know what it is to be driven out as refugees, and then that situation to become frozen, that you could spend your life and your children's and grandchildren, three generations now of Palestinians live in refugee camps in Lebanon, and the whole population knows this, that if they leave the South and become refugees, if they allow the Israelis to drive them out, that going home and their whole future is in question. So the very day the bombing ended, when there was a call put forth to return to the South, people in droves went home and began this very difficult work of rebuilding. And so every town we went into, there were folks shoveling and there were big earth-moving equipment and dump trucks and folks camped out. And also describing to us some of their, you know, they were very proud of the kind of resistance that they had put up. And it was especially women who would often describe for us. I think men were much more aware because there's such a policy of targeted assassinations by anyone who's seen as perhaps a leader or a spokesperson for Hezbollah, that men were much more conscious, and even a number of women, of being on camera. So that was also often a question for us. We always had to ask people, are you willing to be on camera? Are you willing to be interviewed? In the discussion period, I think we should also just talk about the role of Israel within the entire region as an outpost, the role of Zionism as first a support for British colonialism in the area to divide, and the role that it plays today as really a, you know, it's described as a 51st state. and $15 million a day over 50 years, there's what that would do even to any city in the U.S. It's created an artificial military economy that is carries out an occupation of the Palestinian people and carries out a policy of endless war in the region. The possibility of wider war against Syria and Iran, which this seemed to be the launching pad for, has been set back. It's not off the agenda. And 4 days ago, there were the U.S. Again carried out in the Persian Gulf huge military exercises, like a mock invasion of Iran. They fired missiles, they had gunboats, destroyers, aircraft missiles just off the Iranian coast. Iran responded by firing some of their test missiles. And it was really giving a warning to the U.S. But we should just know that as desperate as the war in Iraq is, that has been warned so many times that the Pentagon is mad. It's true. There is an arrogance of power. But there is also a growing awareness in the world today that organized people's resistance, even against overwhelming super weapons that they have, can stop and can push out the occupying forces. And that is a source of enormous, there is a change taking place throughout the Arab world and taking place also, you could look at Latin America today, where it seemed free trade agreements were unstoppable just a couple of years ago. And in country after country, we're not only talking about Venezuela or Bolivia or Nicaragua again with the Sandinistas. Whole new possibilities are coming forward where people are becoming more conscious of their own power and also more determined to confront U.S. corporate power. I'm going to end by saying that the U.S. government today, regardless of who is elected into office, this is not a government that represents our interests or our needs or any of the things that really represent poor and working people in the U.S. today. We have today a criminal government that has invaded and destroyed countries all around the world, and that at the same time is laying waste right here in the U.S. Environmentally, is pursuing policies that put the entire planet at risk. We are the one industrialized country of the world that does not have a national health plan, and more than 40 million people with no health care whatsoever. We have the largest prison population in the world. We have the largest population of youth who really have no future, no plans, no real training and job skills. And all of this is really the cost of endless war. And so whenever these policies are defeated, it actually strengthens us, our interests. Although it's not presented that way in the media, it's very important for us to actually take heart when the Pentagon war machine is stopped anywhere in the world, because if it strengthens people's resistance anywhere, it truly also strengthens us.